No, I do not want to see an elderly Hmong woman with multiple complaints and depression. I will take your coughs and your back problems, but don't give me one of those. In order to show that they were taking the complaints seriously, some doctors prescribed what they called the Hmong cocktail. Motrin, an anti-inflammatory. Elavil, an antidepressant, and vitamin B12. But the patients did not usually get better. For the underlying problems, explained Bill Selvidge, there were no treatment that it was in my power to offer. If Hmong patients left the family practice clinic without a prescription, for example, if they had a cold or flu, they sometimes felt cheated and wondered if they were being discriminated against. But if they were given a prescription, no one knew if it would be followed. You'd say, take a tablespoon of that, said Marie Muckus, a nurse at the clinic. They'd say, what's a tablespoon? One patient refused to swallow a pill because it was an inauspicious color. Long-term therapy, for example, the doses of isoniazid that must be taken every day for a year to treat tuberculosis was always problematic, especially if the illness was asymptomatic. Whatever the prescription, the instructions on pill bottles were interpreted not as orders but as malleable suggestions. Afraid that medicines designed for large Americans were too strong for them, some Hmong cut the dosage in half. Others double-dosed so they would get well faster. It was always frightening for the doctors to prescribe potentially dangerous medications lest they be misused. In one notorious case, the parents of a large Hmong family en route from Thailand to Hawaii were given a bottle of motion sickness pills before they boarded the plane. They unintentionally overdosed all their children. The older ones merely slept, but by the time the plane landed, the infant was dead. The medical examiner elected to withhold the cause of death from the parents, fearing that they would be saddled by an impossible burden of guilt if they had learned the truth. When a Hmong patient required hospitalization, MCMC nurses administered the medications and the doctors could stop wondering whether the dose was going to be too high or too low. There was plenty else to worry about. When they walked into a hospital room, they often had to run a gauntlet of a dozen or more relatives. Decisions, especially about procedures such as surgery that violated Hmong taboos, often took hours. Wives had to ask their husbands. Husbands had to ask their elder brothers. Elder brothers had to ask their clan leaders, and sometimes the clan leaders had to telephone even more important leaders in other states. In emergency situations, the doctors sometimes feared that their patients would die before permission could be obtained for life-saving procedures. All too often, permission was refused. They won't do something just because somebody more powerful says to do it, said Dan Murphy. They will sit back and watch and sort of mentally chew over it and then say they may or may not do it. That attitude has been very culturally adaptive for the Hmong for thousands of years, and I think that it is still culturally adaptive, but when it hit the medical community, it was awful. Teresa Callahan once saw a patient in the emergency room who had an ectopic pregnancy that required the immediate removal of a fallopian tube. I told her over and over again that if the tube ruptured at home, she might die before she could get into the hospital. I called her husband and her mother and her father and her grandparents, and they all said nope. All that mattered to them was that she would have one less tube, and she might not be able to have kids after that. And when they heard that, it was, no, 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 no. She'd rather die. I had to watch her walk out the door, knowing she had something that could kill her. Several days later, the woman consented to the surgery after consulting a Thai doctor in Fresno. Teresa does not know how he persuaded her. Another Hmong woman, examined shortly before she went into labor, was told that because her baby was in a breech position, a cesarean section was indicated. Although breech births in Laos often meant death to both mother and child, the woman attempted to give birth at home rather than submit to the surgery. The attempt failed. Dave Schneider was on call when an ambulance brought her to the hospital. "I got paged at 3 or 4 a.m., he recalled. "Dr. Schneider, stat to the emergency room. There's a lady coming in with a breech baby that won't come out. The paramedics came in wheeling this Hmong woman on a gurney. She was making no noise, just moving her head around in panic. There was a blanket partly over her. I have a very clear visual memory of lifting the covers to reveal a pair of little blue legs, not moving, hanging out of her vagina." Dave delivered the baby vaginally by manually stretching the cervix over its head. The mother recovered, but the baby died of oxygen deprivation. Most Hmong women did go to the hospital to give birth, erroneously believing that babies born at home would not become U.S. citizens. Doctors were more likely to encounter them on the labor and delivery floor than in any other medical context because they had so many children. In the mid-80s, the fertility rate of Hmong women in America was 9.5 children, which, according to one study, was at the upper limits of human reproductive capacity, second only to the Hutterites. The fertility rate of white Americans is 1.9 children, and of black Americans, 2.2. This rate has undoubtedly decreased, though it has not been recently quantified as young Hmong have become more Americanized, but it is still extraordinarily high. The large size of Hmong families is the inevitable result of two circumstances. Hmong women usually marry during their teens, sometimes as early as 13 or 14, thus allowing their reproductive years to extend nearly from menarche to menopause. And, as a rule, they are highly suspicious of contraception. In 1987, when Donald Renard, a researcher on refugee issues at the Center for Applied Linguistics in Washington, D.C., visited Ban Vinay, he learned that in an effort to curb the exploding birth rate of the camp's inhabitants, the administrators had promised free cassette recorders to women who volunteered to take contraceptive pills. Many women accepted both the tape recorders and the pills, but they soon discovered a marvelous paradox. The contraceptives, which they had probably never intended to swallow in the first place, were a superior fertilizer. So the pills ended up being ground up and sprinkled on Hmong vegetable plots, while the gardeners continued to get pregnant. The Hmong have many reasons for prizing fecundity. The most important is that they love children. In addition, they traditionally value large families because many children were needed to till the fields in Laos and to perform certain religious rites, especially funerals. Because the childhood mortality rate in Laos was so high, because so many Hmong died during the war and its aftermath, and because many Hmong still hope that their people will someday return to Laos and defeat the communist regime. In the refugee camps, Hmong newborns were often referred to as soldiers and nurses. The frequent appearance at MCMC of Hmong women on the Merced public assistance rolls who were about to give birth to their 8th, 10th, or 14th child did not endear them to those staff members who have strong ideas about family planning.
"I am totally disgusted by the breeding rate," said Robert Small, an obstetrician who is well known for his clinical proficiency, his unapologetic contempt for the Hmong, and his propensity for mixed metaphors. "The Hmong breed like flies as if the golden goose of welfare will continue to lay eggs forever."
According to Dr. Small, the Hmong are highly uncooperative obstetrical patients.
"They don't do a damn thing you tell them," he said. "They just come in late and drop it out. In fact, they wouldn't come at all if they didn't need to get that birth certificate so they could get on more welfare. You or I, we can't conceive of the degree of ignorance. They're almost a Stone Age people. Hell, they never went to a doctor before. They just had a baby in the camp or in the mountains or wherever the hell they came from. Because they were approximately as fond of most doctors as Robert Small was of them, Hmong women who arrived in Merced in the refugee influx of the early and mid-80s tended to avoid prenatal care. They were particularly frightened of pelvic exams performed by male doctors. In the Hmong healing system, Zinengs and herbalists who do not touch their patients may treat people of the opposite sex. But in the more intimate sphere of dermal therapy and massage, acupuncture, pinching, coin rubbing, men usually treat men and women women. Once they were in labor, the women preferred to wait until the last minute to arrive at the hospital. They often gave birth in the parking lot, the emergency room, or the elevator. Wheelchairs at MCMC were called Hmong birthing chairs because so many Hmong babies were born in them en route to the labor and delivery floor. Even if they got to the hospital on time, the women made so little noise during labor that the hospital staff, not realizing birth was imminent, often failed to transfer them from labor beds to delivery tables. A few doctors found this forbearance admirable. We were told in medical school that childbearing is one of the three or four most painful things that could happen to a person, said Dave Schneider. Most women scream. Hmong women don't make any sound at all. They are just remarkably, unbelievably stoic. The obstetric nurses were less impressed by the silence of their Hmong patients. Dan Murphy explained,
The nurse's attitude was more, Why didn't they tell us they were about to deliver? What are they, stupid?
I think it was kind of a displaced anxiety. I don't think that they were angry at the Hmong so much as they were anxious because the Hmong didn't fit the pattern they had been trained to deal with. Some other ways in which Hmong women failed to fit the pattern included squatting during delivery and refusing permission for episiotomy incisions to enlarge the vaginal opening. Although Leah's mother, when she lived in Laos, had preferred to go through labor alone, many Hmong women were used to being held from behind by their husbands who massaged their bellies with saliva and hummed loudly just before the baby emerged. The husbands made it very clear what they expected from the doctors.
One father slapped my hand when I was controlling the progress of the baby's head, recalled Chris Hartwig. The nurses got very upset because he violated the sterile field. Then, as I was clamping the umbilical cord, he reached down and touched the cord and said, This is how long it has to be.
Because neither of the father's demands endangered the health of the mother or the child, Chris Hartwig complied. But what if a patient, or her husband, or father, or brother, who was more likely to make the decision, refused an episiotomy that her doctors believed would prevent an imminent fourth-degree laceration, a laceration that the husband, or father, or brother might then forbid the doctor to stitch up? Or worse still, what if the fetal monitor indicated that the baby's heartbeat had dangerously decelerated and the family refused to sign a consent form for an emergency cesarean section? I asked Raquel Arias, by common consent, the MCMC obstetrician with the most dazzling combination of skill and empathy, what she did when the wishes of her Hmong patients conflicted with the standard of medical care that she was accustomed to providing. I have the same standard of care for the Hmong as I have for everyone else, she said. My hands are just tied to provide it, so I give them suboptimal care. Sometimes you can find middle ground and try to understand where they are coming from, which is hard, but not impossible. Sometimes you can persuade them to do what you want. You keep telling them stuff, and if you want it bad enough, then maybe it'll work. It is when the well-being of the fetus is in jeopardy. A fetus that, in our perspective, is a full person who should have the rights and privileges that all citizens of this country have, and the beliefs and customs of the family seem to be going against what you believe, is in the fetus's best interest, that you have the worst conflict. When that happens, it is an unbelievably terrible situation to be in. It is awful.
It is not the kind of tension you feel when you get mad at someone from your own background who is doing something they know is bad, like smoking or drinking while they are pregnant. This is a different kind of tension because they don't know that they are doing something bad. According to their beliefs and principles, they are trying to protect the mother and the baby and their way of life. And what you think is necessary happens to be exactly the opposite of what they think is appropriate. Listening to Raquel, I was struck, as I often was, by the staggering toll of stress that the Hmong exacted from the people who took care of them, particularly the ones who were young, idealistic, and meticulous. During Hmong labors that were going badly, Raquel bit her fingernails, which were impeccably polished with purple passion enamel, to the quick. Suki Walker, a psychologist at Merced Community Outreach Services, who was highly regarded in local Hmong circles, went through a period of throwing up before going to work each morning. Benny Douglas, a resident who was known for his imperturbable calm, was so upset by one problematic case. An elderly Hmong woman had gastric cancer, and Benny hadn't been able to persuade her sons to consent to her surgery, that he developed severe insomnia. I remember seeing Benny slumped forlornly in a chair, alone in the residence's call room at dusk, dictating his notes about Mrs. Tao into a little tape recorder while he drank cup after Tommy Tippy cup of coffee and reflexively picked at his eyelashes. When I asked Dan Murphy why he thought caring for the Hmong caused so much stress, he said, "People in the early years of their medical careers have invested an incredible amount of time and energy and pain in their training. And they have been taught that what they've learned in medical school is the only legitimate way to approach health problems. I think that is why some young doctors go through the roof when Hmong patients reject what we have to offer them, because it intimates that what Western medicine has to offer is not much." The only doctor I met in Merced who seemed untroubled either by his encounters with the Hmong or by the question of whether he was providing optimal care, was Roger Fifey, a family physician who served his residency at MCMC in the early 80s and then joined the staff of a local private hospital. Dr. Fifey estimated that 70% of his clientele was Hmong, a fraction unequaled in any other practice in town. When I asked him why he was so popular, he was able to offer no explanation other than, "Maybe I talk slower than the other doctors." His patients have no problem explaining. Every Hmong I asked said exactly the same thing. "Dr. Fifey doesn't cut." On the whole, that was true. Dr. Fifey generally did not perform episiotomies on Hmong women, though he did not know why they didn't want them, never having asked. He avoided cesarean sections whenever possible, and he had particularly endeared himself to his Hmong patients by handing them their babies as placentas in plastic bags whenever they requested them, though he had no idea what they did with them, and said he had never been curious. Roger Fifey is not held in high esteem at MCMC. "He's a little thick," one resident told me. "He's not the most intelligent graduate our program has ever had," said another. "He's an adequate physician," said a third, choosing his words carefully. Though I doubt that even the most ecumenical of Merced's doctors would wish to have more Hmong patients, still, it must have been galling for those residents to realize that the Hmong community overwhelmingly preferred a doctor whose standard of care they believed to be inferior to their own. Roger Fifey happened to espouse a philosophy that carried more weight with the Hmong than any degree of knowledge, intelligence, or technical skill. When I asked him why he didn't usually force his Hmong patients to comply with conventional American medical practices, he shrugged and said, "It's their body." Chapter 7. Government Property. Neil Ernst was a doctor of a different breed. It would have gone completely against his grain to apply two different standards of care to his patients, a higher one for the Americans and a lower one for the Hmong. But might Lia Lee have been better off if her family had brought her to Roger Fifey? Might Neil actually have compromised Leah's health by being so uncompromising? That latter question still bothers him. For example, if Leah's prescriptions hadn't been changed so often, her parents might have been more likely to give her her medications, since they would have been less confused and more confident that the doctors knew what they were doing. Neil was pretty sure, however, that because Leah's condition was progressive and unpredictable, he could treat it best by constantly fine-tuning her drug regimen. If he had chosen a single, pretty good anticonvulsant and stuck with it, he would have had to decide that Leah wasn't going to get the same care he would have given the daughter of a middle-class American family who would have been willing and able to comply with a complex course of treatment. Which would have been more discriminatory? To deprive Leah of the optimal care that another child would have received? Or to fail to tailor her treatment in such a way that her family would be most likely to comply with it? A decade ago, that is not the way Neil looked at the situation. He never seriously considered lowering his standard of care. His job, as he saw it, was to practice good medicine. The Lees' job was to comply. Lack of compliance constituted child endangerment, which is a form of child abuse. He postponed calling Child Protective Services for as long as he could, giving Leah's parents every possible chance to reform, talking the case over with his wife nearly every night, worrying that what happened in Fresno might happen in Merced. He and Peggy had both heard and believed the rumor about the Hmong father in Fresno who hanged himself in his prison cell after being unjustly arrested for child abuse. Neil finally decided that he had no choice but to request that Leah be placed in foster care. Other options he has considered in retrospect, such as arranging for a nurse to visit the Lee house 3 times a day to give Leah her medicine, or enlisting the help of Hmong community leaders to increase parental compliance, either seemed, at the time, to have insuperable bureaucratic obstacles, or simply didn't occur to him. When I asked Neil whether, once he had made up his mind, he continued to brood about the effect his decision would have on the Lee family, he said, "Yeah, sure. I mean, you always do. But you get so single-minded about the child's welfare that you can pretty effectively suppress any kind of bad feelings you have about what you do to the parents." And there was another part. And here I am speaking for myself, not for Peggy, which is that I felt that there was a lesson that needed to be learned. I don't know if this is a bigoted statement, but I'm going to say it anyway. I felt it was important for these Hmongs to understand that there were certain elements of medicine that we understood better than they did, and that there were certain rules they had to follow with their kids' lives. I wanted the word to get out to the community that if they deviated from that, it was not acceptable behavior. Once he had determined that Leah's parents were endangering her health, it was fully within Neil's legal rights to file a report with Child Protective Services. In fact, he might have committed a crime if he hadn't filed the report. Failure to report child abuse is a prosecutable offense in 44 states, including California. Because physicians, along with other healthcare workers, teachers, daycare employees, and police officers, are especially likely to come across evidence of abuse, all 50 states have immunity clauses in their child welfare laws that protect these groups from civil or criminal charges after they file abuse reports, even if they are found to be wrong. The fact that Leah's parents refused to give her the medications, at least in part because of cultural or religious reasons, of which Neil was only hazily aware, would probably have cut little ice in court, even if the Lees had been savvy enough to try to defend their actions. If a child had not been involved, things would have been different. In cases involving competent adults, the principle of autonomy almost always takes legal precedence over the principle of beneficence, which means, for example, that a Jehovah's Witness has a right to refuse a blood transfusion, or a Christian Scientist a course of chemotherapy, even if he or she dies as a result. But with a minor, the state has the right, indeed the obligation, to force the patient to comply with a life-saving treatment, even if it is forbidden by the family's religion.
Parents may be free to become martyrs themselves, wrote Justice Robert Jackson in a 1943 Supreme Court decision. But it does not follow that they are free, in identical circumstances, to make martyrs of their children.
Several parents who belong to fundamentalist sects have been jailed after the deaths of the children whom they have attempted to cure with faith healing. No Christian Scientist has yet been imprisoned, though several have been convicted of involuntary manslaughter or child endangerment and sentenced to a combination of fines, probation, and community service. If parents who practice these relatively mainstream religions have so consistently failed to sway the courts, it is doubtful that a judge would have been favorably impressed that the Lees informed him that they were shamanistic animists who believed their daughter's illness was caused by the loss of her soul and could be treated most effectively by animal sacrifice. Neil never had any desire to have Leah's parents prosecuted, and no legal action was ever taken against them. All he wanted was to get Leah out of their hands and into the stewardship of someone who would administer her medications exactly as he prescribed them. On May 2, 1985, she was placed temporarily in a foster home run by two Mennonite sisters who, whenever she became hyperactive, strapped her into an infant car seat on the living room floor. After 2 weeks, she was returned home, and her parents were given one last chance. Blood tests continued to show that they were giving her less than the prescribed dose of Tegretol. At this point, the Merced Department of Child Protective Services filed petition number 15270 with the Superior Court of the State of California. In the matter of Leah Lee, a person coming within the provisions of the juvenile court law, the petition began. Your petitioner is informed, believes, and therefore alleges, 1. That the above-named minor resides at 37 East 12th Street, Apartment A, Merced, California. 2. That said minor is 2 years, 11 months of age, having been born on the 19th day of July, 1982. 3. That said minor comes within the provision of Section 300, Subdivision A, of the Juvenile Court Law of the State of California, as follows. Said minor is in need of proper and effective parental care and has no parent willing to or capable of exercising such care and control. Said minor is an epileptic with a complex seizure disorder and the parents are administering subtherapeutic medication levels. As a result of parents' failure to comply with medication instructions, said minor has had multiple hospitalizations and severe seizures which have been life-threatening. The doctor states that said minor needs to be removed from the parental home at this time to preserve the life of said minor. There is a substantial danger to the physical health of said minor, and there are no reasonable means by which said minor's physical health can be protected without removing the minor from her parents' physical custody. It concluded, wherefore, your petitioner prays that this court declare said minor to be a dependent child of the juvenile court. On June 26th, Leah was removed from her home again, this time for a placement of at least 6 months. Her parents were not notified in advance that she was going to be taken. When the CPS workers arrived, Fool was out of the house visiting relatives. Several years later, Nakao told me, through an interpreter, what had happened. He was under the impression that the social workers, who were accompanied by a Hmong interpreter named Su Zhong, were police officers. "The police came to take Leah away. Su told the doctor that we didn't give Leah any medicine, and that is why the doctors got mad and they came to take Leah away. I was very angry. I almost killed the translator. I said, 'This is my child. I love her.' And the police said for 6 months, Leah is government property." Four told me, "When I came home, my husband told me that they took the baby, and he said that they didn't tell them where they took the baby. I didn't know any English, so I didn't know what to think or what to say. I told my elder relatives, but they said, 'Well, if those people came to take her, then you can't do anything.' I cried so much that I thought my eyes would go blind." It was interesting to me that almost none of the MCMC residents, even those who had taken care of Leah many times in the emergency room and years later, could recall the medical aspects of her case in minute detail, were aware, until I told them that Neil had arranged to have Leah removed from her family. When they heard about it, every one of them disagreed with his decision, though none of them could suggest a better alternative. Neil had not deliberately concealed what had happened. It was simply not his habit to discuss emotionally charged topics, especially ones about which he felt apprehensive or ambivalent, with anyone but his wife. When I told Dan Murphy about Leah's placement in foster care, he was astounded. "Neil must have been just desperate to do something like that," he said. "That's the first time I've ever heard of a child being taken away from good caretakers. You know, it's usually somebody who is willfully harming their child, either through extreme neglect or through actually doing them damage. But Leah's parents really loved their kid. If I was in another country and somebody took my kid for reasons that I couldn't understand, I would at least start considering violent alternatives. I really would." In Merced's Hmong community, especially among the Lee and Yang clans, everyone knew about what had happened. The news of Leah's disappearance confirmed what many people had already suspected, that doctors were not to be trusted, and that they were in league with other coercive authorities. A lesson of sorts, but not the one Neil had in mind. Long after the event, I asked Kia Lee and Kuo Her, two Hmong interpreters who worked for the public health department, what they had thought of the matter. Kia is a woman, and Kuo is a man. They both remembered it well. "Maybe they should not take Leah away," said Kia diplomatically. "Maybe this was not right. The parents not want to hurt the child. They try very hard to be good parents. They lost many child in Laos, and they love this child very, very much. In Laos, the parent have 100% responsibility over the child. How can you say you can take it away unless it is an orphan?" Kuo said more sharply, "It was not necessary for CPS to take the kid. If they don't care about the kid, okay, but parents love the kid more than others in the house. The mother was crying and crying all the time. The father, he was not crying. He was very angry. Hmong men do not cry, even if you feel sad. In Laos, I never heard of this happening in my life." In a master's thesis in anthropology called Analysis of Cultural Beliefs and Power Dynamics in Disagreements About Healthcare of Hmong Children, a Minnesota physician named Kathleen Ann Culhane Parra summarized the Hmong attitude toward responsibility in pediatric medical cases. "Hmong parents believe parents are responsible for the child's welfare and for deciding the child's medical treatment. since parents gave birth to the child, provide for the child's physical needs, and love the child, they are the ones who decide the treatment approach for the child. Because family members love the child and are part of the family, they can assist the parents in making decisions about the optimal actions. Respected family lineage leaders also assist parents in making difficult decisions about serious conditions. But as physicians are not family members, they cannot make decisions for the child. If doctors take over the parents' responsibility and decide to treat without parental permission, then doctors are responsible for the consequences. If the child dies, it is their fault. And how will they repay the parents? Indeed, how will they pay for the life? As long as doctors and parents continue to negotiate, even if they disagree, the conflict is confined to differences in belief systems. Once the police are called and court orders are obtained, however, the difficulties escalate to another level, wrote Colhane Para. The differences are no longer about beliefs. The differences are about power. Doctors have power to call the police and to access state power, which Hmong parents do not have. Because the Hmong have historically been so resistant to authority, they are especially confused and enraged when they are stripped of their power in a country to which they have fled because of its reputation for freedom. As one parent whose sick child was forced to have a spinal tap after the doctor obtained a court order told Colhane Para, "The way we feel, the United States is more communist than our country is." Another angry parent who had had a similar experience told her, "No matter how much we don't know about technology, about human health, physical, but we have seen a lot in experience too. I don't want any doctor to treat any human being like an animal. Animals, they don't understand. But human beings do. We do know how to talk. We do understand like anyone who is human being. We are just refugees, but we are human beings like any doctor too." Once a child is removed from parental custody, Child Protective Services must file an explanatory petition within 2 days, and a detention hearing is usually scheduled for the day after the petition is filed. Nakao Lee appeared in court on June 28, 1985, accompanied by a public defender. No one remembers whether an interpreter was there as well. The judge approved CPS's petition to detain Lee. Nakao, who was unaware that it was permissible to object, is recorded as assenting. The plan detailed in the disposition of case number 15270 called for Lee to remain in foster care for 6 months, the minimum time that Neil estimated would be needed to stabilize her seizure disorder. Her parents would be permitted weekly visits, though these did not start until she had been away from home for more than a month. In fact, following a policy, common at the time, that was intended to prevent distraught parents from immediately retrieving their children, CPS did not inform Phua and Nakao of their daughter's whereabouts for several weeks. According to Nakao, "After 1 month, I went to my cousin who speaks English and asked him to call the police and ask where Lee is because my wife was missing Lee too much and she was going crazy." Lee was to be reunited with her family after 6 months only if the court was persuaded that her parents could comply with her medication regimen. Child Protective Services was to work with them to increase that likelihood. If the court did not decide within a year that Lee could safely return to her family, the Lees would permanently lose custody. It was the responsibility of CPS to find Lee an appropriate foster home. Her caseworker filled out a form for specialized foster care, that is, care for a child with unusual medical or behavioral problems. Among the behavioral problems of child that she circled were, has had one or more violent episodes causing minor physical injury within the last year, has caused minor property damage on 6 or more occasions within the last year. Displays self-interest behavior, biting, scratching at least once a month. Becomes aggressive or hostile when frustrated. Does not participate in social activities. Does not participate in group projects. Is hyperactive in all environments. Is resistive in all situations. Has temper tantrums daily. The caseworker was told to add up the points and rank the cumulative severity of the problem behavior on a scale from 40, the best, to 70, the worst. At 81, Leah's score was off the scale. The only categories in which she received favorable, indeed perfect, scores were no evidence of depressive behavior, responds to affection appropriately, and gives affection appropriately. A day or two before Leah was removed from her home, Dee and Tom Korda, a couple living 25 miles northwest of Merced, who had recently been certified as foster parents, received a call from CPS. "We've got a 2-year-old Hmong girl with epilepsy," said the social worker. "Can you handle it?" At the time, Dee Korda had never heard the word Hmong, had 4 children of her own, was pregnant with her 5th, and was taking care of another foster child, her 1st. "Sure," she said. Dee told me several years later, "I was so eager, I would have taken anything they offered. I was curious to meet the Kordas, because when I called Dee, the first thing she had said was, 'How are Fu and Akau? Don't you just love them?' Since at that point, I had never heard an American say a good word about the Lees, and since I subscribe to the conventional wisdom that biological parents and foster parents are natural enemies, her question threw me somewhat off balance. When I arrived at the Cordes' rambling one-story house, which was in a dairy community dotted with peach and almond orchards, I was greeted by several large dogs that Dee and Tom, with the help of the 5 biological and 6 foster children, most of them retarded or emotionally disturbed, who were living with them at the time, were raising as canine guides for the blind. As we sat in the living room, Dee simultaneously showed me a small scrapbook full of pictures of Leah. She keeps one for every child she has cared for, and dispensed hugs to children of various sizes and races who wandered in and out. After Leah arrived in the Korda house, she cried continuously for 10 days. "Leah was the only child I've ever heard who could cry while inhaling and exhaling," said Dee. "In and out, loud and abrasive, on and on and on. I know she was crying for them, for her mom and dad, even though she didn't know the words to tell me. I'd find her curled in the bathtub, her face real worried and troubled and confused and sad. Sometimes she would pound at the door like a caged animal and shout, 'Nah, nah, nah, nah.' Now I know that means daddy in Hmong. In fact, Leah was probably saying Nia, pronounced Na, which means mother. The word for father is Zi. Because the Kordas spoke no Hmong, they had no way of comforting Leah verbally. The only thing that seemed to help was constant physical contact. During the day, Dee simultaneously carried Leah in a backpack and her own youngest child, who was 9 months old when Leah arrived, in a front pack. At night, Leah usually slept in the Kordas' bed, which was 10.5 feet wide, large enough to accommodate a substantial fraction of the household. When Leah was inconsolable, Dee, guessing correctly that she had never been weaned, breastfed her alongside her own baby. If there was ever going to be a way, it was Leah's way, she told me. That's what she's used to. Her family let her rule the roost at home because she was the special child, the princess. Oh, Leah could be ornery and strong-willed, but she was a sweetie, too. She'd crawl on your lap. She was so beautiful. We didn't mean nothing to her at first, but she learned to love us. She knew how to love and how to let people love her. We were blessed to have Leah. Janine Hilt, the CPS caseworker, frequently visited the Cordas during this period and kept a welfare services contact record that gives some idea of what the Cordas' less blessed days with Leah were like. Some of the entries. Leah's problems are very behavioral. Cries constantly. Real disruptive, real anger. Will cry on, nonstop, 2 to 5 a.m. Kicking. Won't give in. Family is on edge. Tantruming. Withholds food. Looks at D, takes off her panties and pees. Pooping on floor now. Bit herself on lip. Leah crying 4 days straight. Smearing feces. Intense crying again. Stripped herself. Peed on the floor. Went on a wave of destruction. Had to sedate her. Noting that Leah had inflicted numerous injuries on other children ranging from bruises to cuts requiring stitches. That she required constant supervision to keep her from activities that she previously experienced as harmful or dangerous, for example, hot water, bathtubs, high places, swimming pools, etc. And that the Cordas were providing an extremely high level of care, Janine Hilt successfully petitioned the Department of Human Resources to pay Dee and Tom the unusually high fee of $1,000 a month for taking care of Leah. The Lees had supported themselves and the 7 of their 9 surviving children who were living at home, including Leah, on a $790 a month in welfare payments plus $84 that Leah, whose epilepsy had qualified her for disability funding, received as supplemental security income. In her letter to the Department of Human Resources, Janine Hilt also noted that Dee Corda was taking Leah to between 2 and 5 doctor's appointments a week. Despite the fact that Dee followed the anticonvulsant prescriptions to the letter, a task that sometimes required holding Leah down and repeating the doses after she spat them all over Dee's clothes, Leah was still seizing. In fact, she seized more frequently at the Cordas's than she had when she was living with her own family. She was hospitalized 4 times at Emmanuel Medical Center in Turlock, the town nearest to the Cordas's home, and on one occasion was transferred from Emmanuel to MCMC, which did not make a favorable impression on Dee. The MCMC nurses wouldn't talk to her nice and soft, she told me. When she swilled her bed, it wasn't, "Oh, honey," it was, "Oh, my God, what a mess." They'd tie both arms and both legs with cloth, like nursing homes used on old people. It was degrading. Leah's new doctors in Turlock changed her prescription several times, eliminating first the phenobarbital and then the tegretol and substituting various combinations of Dilantin, Depakane, and Ritalin. According to Dee, the new regimens had fewer side effects. Tegretol and phenobarbital were the worst combination for Leah, she said. The worst! When she took them, she was drunk. She couldn't navigate or walk. I think that's why her parents wouldn't give them to her. Then she'd have a seizure and everyone would get mad at them. Leah's coordination improved, but her seizures continued. After they found out where their daughter had been taken, Leah's family visited her whenever their nephew, who owned a car, could give them a ride. The first time they visited, Deed showed them how she carried Leah on her back, just the way Four did, and how Leah slept in the family bed. The Quarter children lent the Lee children bathing suits, and they all swam together in the backyard pool. Payne crawled on the lawn with Dee's baby. Eventually, the Lees' 12-year-old daughter May became friends with the Cordas' 10-year-old daughter Wendy, and once spent a whole week at their house. Four embroidered a Nia, a Hmong baby carrier for Dee. A few months went by. Dee started leaving her own baby with Fua when she took Leah to medical appointments. perhaps the first instance in the history of Child Protective Services that a foster mother has asked a legally abusive parent to babysit for her. It did not take the court as long to decide that CPS had made a mistake in taking Leah away from her family. Though CPS, when Dee told them so, did not agree.
"I was attached to Leah, but she really needed to be at home," said Dee. "Four and Nakao were so warm, so caring, and they loved that child so much. I'm bitter. They never should have been in the system."
By the time I met Dee, she had taken care of a total of 35 foster children, most of whom had been severely battered or sexually abused by their parents. Leah was the only one for whom she had ever recommended reunification. At the end of each of the Lees' visits to the Cordes' house, Leah tried to get in the car with them and screamed with panic when they drove away without her. Nakao told me,
"The family really took care of Leah and really cared for her, too. But maybe she missed us too much, and that is why she got sicker. We missed her, too. I do not know how to describe how we missed her."
Four said,
"Our bed was empty without her. I loved her a lot, and I had always held her during the night and didn't let her sleep by herself. I cried every night when I got into the bed and she was not there."
2 months after Leah had been taken from her family, Nakao told the caseworker that he wanted to commit suicide if Leah did not come home. 4 months after that, Nakao came home to find Fua pointing a knife at herself. He took the knife away. A month later, Janine Hilt's case log noted that Fua was hysterical and threatening suicide again. Child Protective Services considered placing the entire family in a psychiatric hospital, but decided against it. Leah did not return home after 6 months as the Lees had expected her to. On December 18, 1985, at the 6-month reunification hearing, the court ruled that Fua and Nakao had failed to demonstrate their ability to comply with their daughter's medical regimen. First, they had refused to sign a social services plan that had been presented to them in August, which stated, among other things, that in order for reunification eventually to take place, the Lees must agree to make and meet medical appointments for our child, including appointments for routine care and illness, and learn how to properly administer her medication. A CPS worker wrote on the plan, "Their feeling is that Leah should be returned to their care at once. Consequently, they declined to sign the agreement." Second, when Leah had been permitted a week-long home visit in September as a test of her parents' compliance, they had failed miserably. The CPS petition against reunification noted, "The parents were again instructed via interpreter on the proper method of administering the medications. Color-coded graphics were also utilized to reinforce the instructions. The parents stated they understood and indicated that they would follow through immediately. During this visit, the parents were allowed to have the minor treated by a shaman from the Hmong culture. Home calls by social workers were completed during the time the minor was at home and the medications were checked, and it appeared as though the medications were being administered. The parents report no seizures. Leah was returned to the foster home on September 9, 1985, and was hospitalized later that day. Blood level checks revealed that no traces of any medications were found in the minor's blood. Dr. Goal, Leah's pediatrician at Emmanuel Medical Center, stated that the parents did not give Leah any medicine as the medication remains in the body for at least 10 days. The medication vials were returned empty by the parents. Janine Hilt wrote in her case log that when Leah returned to the Cordes, her chest was covered with coin-rubbing lesions. Four and Nakao had previously opted for traditional healing techniques and, as Janine noted, trash the meds. 4 days after this home visit, Leah had 3 grand mal seizures and 6 petite mal seizures, after which her developmental deficits became far more pronounced. The petition stated that, "Language delays were noted.
Her motor skills regressed. She would not eat or maintain eye contact, and she engaged in repeated head-banging behavior. Leah also became incapritic, fecally incontinent, engaged in a variety of self-abusive behaviors such as scratching and biting, could not sleep, was abusive to other children, and lost all ability to recognize safe situations. These regressions were all related to the parents' failure to administer the medication while Leah was in their care. Their regressive behaviors have continued. Despite these setbacks, Janine Hilt was determined to try to continue to educate the Lees about Leah's medications so that they could regain custody before 12 months elapsed and they legally lost her for good. Janine spent dozens of hours working with Pho. Her task was aided by the fact that Leah's drug regimen was radically simplified in February of 1986. Dee had taken Leah to Valley Children's Hospital in Fresno for extensive neurological testing, where Terry Hutchison, a pediatric neurologist, reached a tentative diagnosis of Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, a rare form of epilepsy characterized by mental retardation and several forms of hard-to-control seizures. Dr. Hutchison decided that Depakane used alone was the drug of choice. Neil and Peggy had considered Depakane, but had decided against it because it can cause liver failure. Once Leah was started on it, they wished they had prescribed it themselves. Pediatric Depakane is a liquid that tastes pleasantly of cherries, and it was far easier to administer than the complicated combinations of bitter, ground-up pills Leah had previously been taking. Janine showed Pho how to use the plastic syringe to squirt the liquid into Leah's mouth, placing a piece of masking tape at the 8cc mark because Pho couldn't read numbers. Pho practiced with water until she was proficient, then graduated to Depakane. Janine felt that Pho was slowly learning to trust her and was making good progress. She did not develop a similarly intimate relationship with Nakao, who continued to fear that Leah would never come home. He was wary of Janine, but he was not angry at her. His rage was reserved for Su Zhang, the interpreter who had accompanied the CPS workers on the day of Leah's original detention. Su Zhang, a sophisticated, well-educated Hmong woman who had married an American, was not a popular figure in Merced's traditional Hmong community. Intermarriage is rare among the Hmong. According to Janine Hilt, culturally, Su was pretty white, and she dressed real cute and was not at home having babies and sustaining the Hmong culture very well. So a lot of Hmong really saw her as selling out. Su Zhang once told Nakao that she had informed CPS she did not think he should get his daughter back. In February of 1986, when Leah was at Valley Children's Hospital in Fresno, Nakao says Su Zhang scolded him, and he became convinced that she was not accurately translating his statements to the doctors. The next day, back in Merced, Janine Hilt, Su Zhang, and a CPS supervisor came to the Lee house. Nakao Lee told me, "I was outside and Su came inside, and she called me and said, 'Come here, you come in here.' At that time, I was ready to hit Su, and I got a baseball bat right there. My son-in-law was with me, and he grabbed me and told me not to do it. The supervisor and Jenny asked what's the matter, and my son-in-law translated what I was saying, and I said I did not like Su, and I was going to beat Su to death right there that day. And then Su said that she had a lot of work to do, so she left. I told the supervisor, 'This person is not good. Do not bring her here anymore. If you bring her here again, I'm going to get a gun and shoot her.' When I called Su Zhang to ask her about this incident, at first she told me, in the most elegant English I had ever heard a Hmong woman speak, that she could not recall either the argument or the Lee family, which I found surprising since I knew that before she married her American husband, she had been married to Nakao's nephew. Finally, she said, 'The family didn't appreciate my services, so I didn't want to be involved anymore.' It is a credit to Janine Hilt's faith in the Lees that Su Zhang's near encounter with Nakao's baseball bat did not permanently disqualify them from regaining custody of their daughter. The way Janine saw it, Nakao had plenty of reasons to be angry, and as long as he didn't take his anger out in the form of medical noncompliance, it should not interfere with the reunification of his family. Starting on February 18th, 1986, the Lees were permitted